Major funding for On Point is provided by Liberty Mutual for all your auto, home, life, and business insurance needs. Liberty Mutual. Responsibility. What's your policy?
From WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. San Francisco's Golden Gate Bridge is arguably still one of the wonders of the world. No longer the longest suspension bridge, no longer the tallest, but it still may be the most beautiful, its silent orange towers floating on bright days or standing tall through banks of fog. To this day, it is an icon, and California's own son and state historian Kevin Starr has written a book to tell us why. This hour On Point, the story of the Golden Gate Bridge. You can join the conversation. Have you seen the Golden Gate Bridge? What does it mean to you? You can also comment at our website, onpointradio.org, or on Twitter and Facebook, at On Point Radio. Joining me this hour from San Francisco is Kevin Starr. He teaches history at the University of Southern California and is the Emeritus State Librarian of California. His new book is Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. Kevin Starr, it's a pleasure to have you join us. Welcome.
Jane, it's good to be here.
Take us back, sir, if you would, in American history to just before the Golden Gate Bridge was built. What was happening? Describe that moment in time for us.
Well, it was a very challenging time. The bridge construction really began about 1932. It was a challenging time. The Great Depression was showing itself. Great Depression took a little longer to get out to California because you didn't have a heavy industrial base in California at that time. But by 1932, even Californians were aware that there was a major economic challenge on the horizon that could be lasting for some time.
So we'll talk about what makes the Golden Gate so iconic in America a little bit later. But first, tell us about its design. You've set the stage now for the time when this was happening. But talk about its design and construction.
The first design, Jane, was proposed in the early 1920s, and it was proposed as a memorial to the Americans who had fallen in the First World War. It was two cantilevered structures approaching each other from either side of the strait with a suspension structure in the middle. It was put forth by Joseph Strauss and Mulholland, the city engineer of San Francisco, William Mulholland. And critics called it, it looked like an upside-down rat trap. It was not a very attractive project design. And that design sort of stayed there through the 1920s as they planned the bridge and organized the bridge district. But by 1928-29, Strauss knew that if he was going to keep in charge of this project, and he was the leading bridge builder, one of the leading bridge builders in the country at the time, he'd need a new design. And he and the Bridge District assembled this remarkable team, Leon Mosieff, O.H. Ammon, Charles Duluth, Charles Alton Ellis, University of Illinois, Irving Marl, the architect locally, John Boardman, the designer of stage sets, based out of Chicago. So this great work of art, as well as great work of engineering, was team designed. And I think that's a very interesting point because it fits into that whole sense of communal regeneration that the Great Depression tended to nurture.
You talked first about this memorial being this bridge being a memorial to those who'd fallen in war. Were there practical considerations, though? There wasn't really a route from San Francisco to Marin County at the time.
Well, absolutely. And as you know, Jane, if you look at the whole architecture, the whole geography, rather, of the Bay Area, the population center, San Francisco, was on the edge of a peninsula jutting into the bay and lined on its west by the Pacific. And at this period in the late teens, early 20s, towards half the population of the state was clustered around that area. And you couldn't get to San Francisco. San Francisco couldn't get to its hinterlands except by ferry boat. Or you could go all the way down to San Jose and then come all the way back, which is an enormous journey. So basically, from the 1870s onward, there had been calls for a bridge, one bridge across to the East Bay, across now the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, mm-hmm. and one bridge across the Great Strait of the Golden Gate, named by John Charles Fremont in the early 1840s. In fact, one of the first proposals was an alleged madman. I say alleged because he might be crazy like a fox, Emperor Norton, who proclaimed himself Emperor of the United States and Protector of Mexico, and he called for this bridge to be built in the 1870s, among others. Mm.
So Joseph Strauss's first design of the Golden Gate Bridge was rejected, as you say, and I read in your book that he resubmitted the design with details that added some lighting to outline the bridge's cables and towers. Is that right?
Yes, his team reconceptualized the whole thing. Leon Moisseiff was making bridges lighter and lighter and lighter. In fact, this great designer, an immigrant from Latvia to the United States, you'd think that the most perfect bridge for him would be almost aerodynamic. It would almost take off like an airplane. So that was part of it. Joseph Brodmann and then later Irving Morrow, dealing with the towers, to create the towers as great theatrical expressions. Brodmann was designer of theaters, proscenium arches, theatrical presentations. And so that combination of lightness and those great towers, plus the engineering, the suspension engineering that was worked out by Charles Alton Ellis, University of Illinois, former professor at the University of Illinois, who worked those calculations out without a computer. Mm. He sat down in paper and pencil and decided that this bridge would hold, could make it. And so you have a team effort there.
So when did construction then actually begin, and how long did it last? Because that was a feat, my goodness.
Well, it certainly was. Construction basically is 32 to 37, finishes in May 37. And the construction was done on time and on budget, actually slightly under budget, under the supervision of Russ Cohn. Russ Cohn was the supervising engineer, and he was an extraordinary supervisor. Plus, at a time of depression, when people were out of work, suddenly there's this opportunity for the American working person to show his or her chops, if you will, get good employment. And so both bridges, the Golden Gate Bridge and the San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge, were being built simultaneously. These were the largest projects ever conceived of, or much less realized, in the Far West. And they were showing America going back to work. They were showing a revived economy. We have to remember also, Jane, that the Golden Gate Bridge was privately financed. The San Francisco-Oakland Bay Bridge was financed by federal and state money. The Golden Gate Bridge was financed by the Bank of America, who bought the bonds and financed the structure.
So describe the actual process of building the Golden Gate Bridge across that vast surge of water, the bay.
Well, you have a surge of water into which all the rivers of Northern California are draining.
Right.
You have a flow of water out and back. When I was a member of the Dolphin Club in San Francisco, we swam in the bay. I had the privilege of swimming under the bridge at a time when the tides were not coming. Otherwise, I'd be out in Hawaii now. But the power of it's like taking the cumulative power of the Mississippi River, compacting it and rushing it through in an hour or 2 hour periods through the bridge. So you have one of the great movements of water on the planet, and you have great depths, they had to establish initially, and that was one of the big debates, whether the geology underneath the strait could handle the Marin County, the San Francisco edge. The Marin County tower was on the ground, so we knew it could be handled, but they had to really do explorations, and there was a lot of controversy. I detail in my book where many, to include a number of prominent geologists, said this bridge won't hold. The geology underneath, the rock structures, are not capable of sustaining such a bridge. So there was a lot of controversy that was working its way through during the night from the, say, 1922 to 1932 period when construction actually began.
And so I really want to get a picture of this, the size and the weight of those cables, especially back then, that passed through those two main towers, and how difficult that was to construct.
Well, yes, and very interestingly enough, the A.J. Roebling Company, the company that had built the Roebling Company that had built the Brooklyn Bridge, made the successful bid to spin the cables. Now, cables of that strength, capable of sustaining 600 million pound weights and even more, can't be put on the ground and then lifted up onto a tower. There's nothing in the world that could lift up weights like that. You have to spin the cables, weaving the cables together, starting from one little cable, one little strand of it. And so thousands and thousands of strands, the diameter of a pencil, are put together. back and forth by these shuttles that unravel the strand across. When they reach a certain point, they're stamped together, about 36 inches. They're clamped together and put under tremendous hydraulic pressure to be squeezed into one structure, and then they're covered with a sheath. So it was a remarkable weaving with steel, literally, 700 feet above the Pacific. Hmm. Quite dramatic.
And unlike other massive projects of the day, during that construction of the Golden Gate, construction workers were protected, weren't they?
Oh, absolutely. Jane, there was a working formula in bridge design at that period that for every $1 million you spent, you'd lose a life. Now, of course, one life is precious. And when the bridge was nearing completion, when they were pulling off the scaffolding of the undergirder that had sustained the pouring of the concrete for the roadbed, when they were pulling that off, at that point, there was only one person had been killed. A young man was killed by a girder that was swinging around. Now, one is too many, but basically for a $37 million bridge, they might have expected 37 casualties. But Joseph Strauss, the impresario of the bridge, was concerned for safety. He demanded that the men wear leather helmets, which were hard leather helmets, equivalent of a hard hat today. He put a great manila net under the bridge, so in case people fell, about 22 people did fall into it. They were saved. And if you looked like you were hungover, you had to drink a quart of sauerkraut juice before he let you go up the up the tower.
Well, Kevin, I got to take a break here. This is fascinating. We are talking about the Golden Gate Bridge, its story, its construction, what it means for our country. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. More after this break. This is On Point.
Golden Gate, da-da-da-da, I'm coming to you, come on, get hot. Golden Gate, da-da-da-da, sing hallelujah, I live in the sun, ah. Love in the moon, where every month is new. A little sun-kissed blonde, da-da-da-da, is coming my way, right beyond that Lincoln Highway. I'm going strong now, it won't be long now, open up that golden gate.
This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. My guest this hour is Kevin Starr, Emeritus State Librarian for California, a professor of history at the University of Southern California, and author of the award-winning Americans and the California Dream, and author of the new book, Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. Kevin, paint another picture for us. You are full of stories, but I want to get this one because it's great. The draining of the water. The football-sized field sort of drain that had to happen in order to move construction of this bridge across the bay.
Exactly. To pour that much concrete would be is extraordinary in the middle of that water. So you had to create it. Now, the first plan was to take a caisson out, and this was using the established technology. Take a caisson out, which is to say a great steel container, put it over the bridge, the site, and sink it. And then once it's sunk, to pump all the water out. But that caisson, it was hit in an accident by another ship, and it was damaged. So they took that out to the west, and they sunk it. And what they had to do then was to put fenders down. They had to build fenders down, and then pump out the site very slowly. So it was a remarkable. That in and of itself, the construction of that fender was a remarkable achievement of engineering to hold back these titanic waters that were rushing through to create the dryness necessary for the pouring of laying down of steel and pouring of concrete and the drying of that structure. And that pier, San Francisco side pier, is in itself a work of art. It comes up out of the water. You can see it there upon which the tower is resting.
It seems so dynamic in its early construction even. I'm looking at a picture from your book, Ray Strong's famous painting of the bridge that captures that notion of the construction and the massive nature of it.
Well, the world at the time knew something was being done here magnificently, right? Because first of all, you have the art form of photography. And so today we can go back and see the bridge almost day by day under construction. And when those piers were established and the towers rose, even when just the towers were there, the towers were so gorgeous in their stylization, their Art Deco stylization, and Mosieff had thinned them out as they approached the apex, so they had a kind of soaring quality. Even the towers standing there were like the Eiffel Towers, were in and of themselves works of art. And then as the cables were being spun, you began to define the shape of the bridge over the top of the towers. And then as the suspension ropes, they call them, but they're not ropes, they're steel, were being dropped. And then the flatbeds coming in, the beds, slowly over time, this bridge defined itself. And by the last year or so of construction, people knew that they had not only a great work of engineering on hand, but they had a great work of art on hand simultaneously. And that's the power of the bridge. The iconic power of the bridge is that it is at once a practical bridge, it is a work of astonishing engineering, and it's a high work of art. It's, in effect, if not the greatest public sculpture in America.
Well, part of what I think is the power of the bridge is its color, honestly. What about the color of the Golden Gate?
Well, there was a big debate about the color. The War Department at the time wanted black. The Army Air Corps wanted a striped structure because the landing field at Crissy Field was nearby. The Navy wanted a structure with I think yellow and black stripes so that it could be seen through the fog. In the interim, they had the International Orange Primer on there. Now, if you look back to the Panama Pacific Exposition, it was right nearby in 1915. You see those colors that they were, that Jules Guérin, the head of color architecture, was exploring. They were exploring colors that were appropriate to the atmospherics of that dramatic site. And one of those colors was international orange. The primer was that. Then suddenly artists like Benny Bufano, the sculptor in San Francisco, or Maynard Dixon, the artist, they began to say, now, wait a minute. In effect, if it's not broke, don't fix it. International orange is the best color for these atmospherics. And in fact, Jane, I would make the point, and it's been made by many, that the color itself is an essential element fused into the artistic. It's not just decoration. It's an essential element fused into the artistic success of this bridge.
And so how is it maintained?
Well, it's maintained constantly. And I deal with that at the end of the book. I deal with the fact that the bridge is as everything, and I'm not an engineer, and I'm not a physicist either, and I'm not a cosmologist, but the bridge is a defiance. Like everything else we put together, we human beings, it demands maintenance over time, and especially something that's as intricate as this bridge. I mean, one of the towers has 600,000 bolts in it, bolting the steel cells together to make the towers. We're talking about an enormously complex structure in terms of its parts. And so it has to be maintained constantly. It's painted constantly. It's maintained constantly. It's been updated, especially the roadbed in two major instances. At the end, I detail what we've done since the Loma Prieta earthquake has alerted us to the fragility of our structures, the collapse of the Cypress Point Freeway, the Cypress Freeway in during the Loma Prieta has alerted us that the Osaka earthquake. So you have a constant upgrading. Even as we speak now, the whole approach on Doyle Drive is being re-engineered, reconstructed on a massive level to facilitate traffic and also to make the bridge even safer in case of that, not in case of, but when inevitably that larger earthquake returns to San Francisco that visited us in April 1906.
I want to go to the phones, but I just, how many painters at once are working on the Golden Gate?
Well, you could have up to 15 at different times, but there's a permanent crew. I'd say around 15 would sort of cut the difference between a small crew and a larger crew. And they're working constantly. Now, in the early period, the paint was very dangerous because it was lead-based. In fact, in the construction of the bridge, I wanted to get back to last point when there was a collapse and the loss of 10 workers. That was tragic enough, but also you had a number of workers began to suffer from lead poisoning. Mm. And over the years, that's been one of the things that that safety has improved, et cetera, is to prevent against lead poisoning, which is a very debilitating illness, of course.
Let's welcome Karen to the program. She has a question for you. Kevin Starr from Lion Mountain, New York. Hi, Karen. Welcome.
thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I'd like to ask your guest if he can talk a bit about the raw materials on which, of course, the bridge essentially depends. Here in Lion Mountain, which is in the northern Adirondacks of New York State, there is a mountain, Lion Mountain, and from what I understand, most if not all of the iron ore, which is a very high quality, went over to build the Golden Gate Bridge, among other bridges and structures, important structures in this country. The mine
yes, that,
is no longer in use. But do you know about this?
Yes, I do, Karen, and that was handled by the Bethlehem Steel Company, which had the successful bid. Bethlehem Steel is anchored in Pennsylvania, but as you suggest, with mining sites elsewhere, and to include New York, upstate New York, and those the products, the steel products, the steel components were fabricated on the East Coast, and that's an interesting thing about the Golden Gate Bridge. That not only was it nationally designed by a national team of designers from the East and the Midwest and the Far West, it was also fabricated and built by national companies as well as local companies. It wasn't just a local product, a project. And these pieces at heroic costs were either come by rail, those are good, or came by shipping through the Panama Canal, and then were reassembled by Bethlehem Steel out on the site.
Kevin, here's another call from Jack in Worcester, Massachusetts. Hi, Jack. Welcome.
Yes, Jane, I want to sort of on the same vein as the last caller.
Okay.
Here in Worcester, Massachusetts, it's my understanding that the Bethlehem Steelworks, which became U.S. Steel, had the largest wire fabricating operation in the world, in a good proportion, if not all, of the wire strands that were talked about earlier that were woven into the cable came, in fact, from Worcester, Massachusetts. I wonder if he had any comment on that.
Jack, thanks.
Yes, certainly Eastern, but there would be nothing. You're absolutely right, Jack, because there would be nothing on the West Coast that could fabricate like that. California did not get its first steel mill until 1942, during World War II. Henry J. Kaiser put that in Fontana. All these steel products of this advanced sophistication came from New York, Massachusetts, and at one point people said we're going to put enough of these threads in the cables to take us to the moon and back if we had to extend it outward. I don't know if that works out exactly, but certainly a dramatic amount of those pencil thin wires that they were then fused together and woven across this vast space.
Kevin Starr, tell us some of the great stories of the day-to-day operation of the Golden Gate Bridge, especially when it first opened.
Well, when it first opened, it was an extension in part. The bridge not only did it serve a practical purpose, but it was an extension of the City Beautiful movement. The Burnham Plan of 1905, Daniel Hudson Burnham had did a beautiful plan for Chicago, for Manila. He did a beautiful plan for San Francisco in 1905. And in effect, the Golden Gate Bridge took that momentum and projected San Francisco civic life across the strait, the Golden Strait, into the wild headlands of Marin. So it was a wonderfully symbolic statement of wilderness and urbanism. And the day that it opened in May, the city flocked to the bridge, not to the level they did in 1987 when it almost caused a catastrophe or came close to a catastrophe, but the people just love the pedestrian culture of the bridge. And that's an important point, is this bridge was driven by the automobile, driven by the fact that the ferries could no longer, even the ferries operating at 50,000 passengers a day back and forth, could not handle the traffic that was necessary. It was also a pedestrian structure, and to this day, of course, some 10 million people a year walk back and forth across the bridge, enjoying it as one would a cityscape, Battery Park, or walking along the Charles River in Boston.
Hmm. Is it folklore, Kevin, or is it true that, especially in the beginning when it opened, people were so excited to cross the bridge that toll takers were authorized to accept objects, personal objects, as toll?
Well, there was no toll the first day, but the culture developed where you could accept give something, because after all, people in good faith cannot have money on them, And so in my book, I give a catalog of some of the things that were left behind. There's some rather remarkable things, to include prosthetic devices and false teeth and obviously identifications, et cetera, of various kinds. And the vast majority of them redeemed, but some of them not. There should be basically a museum of some of the objects. There's a lot of folklore, Jane, attached to the bridge. And by folklore, I mean reports, especially reports that deal with the interaction of the toll takers and the public. Because they're, in effect, the toll takers make the bridge come alive and become visibly human. At the same time, it's a sort of stressful situation to go through to pay your toll, although now, of course, with electronic means, you can buy a pass that gets you through. And so there's a lot of folklore about connections back and forth between toll takers and the people that show really, I think, in effect, good humor. Every now and then there was an untoward incident, but in part the relationship has been one of good humor, especially given the high stress nature of the job that toll takers had in those early years before the rise of electronic equipment that made it more easy.
Kevin Starr, one of our listeners, T. Daly, wants a clarification of a point that you mentioned. You said the bridge was privately financed. He says he questions that. He says, and lists here the dates, but in November 1930, a $35 million bond was issued.
He's right. The bonds were revenue bonds. They were not general obligation bonds. And the taxpayers said, we'll back these bonds. But they were revenue bonds that came not from taxing. The initial $3 million or so for planning purposes came from taxation, but the general the revenue bonds then were bought by APG&E and the Bank of America, so they were backed by the public, by the Bridge District, which were the counties around the bay, including Del Norte County, but the actual funds were brought into the project by APG&E, and then they were paid off through revenues. So in effect, it's a privately financed, publicly authorized, but privately financed bridge. It's a hybrid.
Good clarification. Thank you, T. Daly. We appreciate your email. Let's go back to the phones. Harry is in Amherst, New York. Hi, Harry. Welcome.
Well, I just wondered if you'd have Mr. Starr elaborate on the engineering considerations, the anti-earthquake engineering considerations for the foundations of the bridge.
All right, Harry, thanks.
Well, in the aftermath of the earthquake and fire, the earthquake especially of April 1906, April 18th, one man emerged as a tremendous figure, and that's Andrew Lawson, who was professor of geology at the University of California at Berkeley. And he was the point person for looking at this question of whether the geological structure could hold. A group of engineers had previously said that it could not, professional engineers. So that would have, in one sense, destroyed the project forever. And in fact, as late as the late 20s, a professor at Stanford University had said that the bridge could not. Lawson headed a team. They went down once the fender was established, they went down. They dug even further down beneath the surface there. They looked at the construction. They looked at the formation, and he said it could go ahead. But Harry's absolutely right. It was a very precarious. It was the big debate, I think, way beyond the technology. Nobody ever argued about the suspension system, which was revolutionary. Nobody argued about the ability of constructors of the Rebling Company to make the cables. But the geology became a problem. And incidentally, Harry, I don't think we should be surprised by that, because the whole Bay Area. The San Andreas Fault was just a few miles away to the east of the bridge. The whole Bay Area rests upon, shall we say, a restive geology. So that issue was a powerful one. A
couple more comments from our website, Kevin Starr. Here's Mark Forziati, who says, I had the pleasure of riding a bike on the Golden Gate Bridge this last May. Great way to truly appreciate the bridge and its construction. And then Vicki Milton from our Facebook page says, we have many beautiful bridges in our country, but the Golden Gate is my favorite. The setting with the lovely city of San Francisco at one end and Marin County on the other, and the tide rolling in and out underneath it is like no other. Whether shining in the sun or shrouded in fog, the bridge is poetry in its beauty. This is On Point. I'm Jane Clayson in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about the Golden Gate Bridge this hour and its place in our history and in our hearts. I've been speaking this hour with Kevin Starr, professor of history at the University of Southern California, emeritus state librarian for California, and author of the new book Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. I'd like to bring another voice into the conversation now. Joining me also from San Francisco is Frank Dean. He's acting superintendent for Golden Gate National Recreation Area. He's from the Bay Area. He's worked for the National Park Service at Alcatraz and Point Reyes National Seashore. It's nice to have you with us, Frank. Welcome.
Thank you, Jane. Happy to be here.
Well, you help manage this area. I'm just curious for you to tell us how people react seeing the Golden Gate Bridge for the first time.
Well, I think there's kind of a mystique and sort of an aura about that bridge. I think part of it is the name itself. It's not named after a man or a person or even a geographic sort of city. So I think there's a mystery and an appeal to that name, the Golden Gate. But when they see it for the first time, it's pretty fun to watch. Most of the pictures that people take of the bridge are from our park, which is on the north and south end anchorages of the bridge. And it's really fun to watch the reaction of people and how excited they are.
I personally have been there at your park night and day. People are there all the time, around the clock, viewing that bridge, aren't they?
Oh, they are, yeah. Yeah, and we've seen a recent trend is the amount of bicycles that go across the bridge, as one of your earlier callers mentioned. We have about 5,000 bicycles a day that go across the bridge now, and that's been a recent phenomenon with the restoration of one of our park sites, Crissy Field, in the last 10 years.
Hmm. Can you describe the bridge as it changes during the day, its different appearance as the fog rolls in, and then its sunrise, its sunset? How does it look different to you during the day?
Well, it's obviously a beautiful structure, and from a park sort of a park guy sort of perspective, I mean, we're all about the landscape. But here you have a beautiful landscape that, and it's rare, but this is actually, the landscape is enhanced by this man-made structure. So I think people are really drawn to it, and it does change throughout the day. We have a pretty dynamic weather here. We have, obviously, night and day, but also during the day there's fog, and even during the evening when the bridge is lit up partially. So you see there's a glow that's created by the lights when there's fog nearby, and so it's a pretty changing dynamic there that people don't seem to get tired of. There's just something that draws you to that view.
Frank Dean, Kevin Starr, we have a couple of listeners who have questions here. Deborah is on the line from Rochester, Vermont. Hi, Deborah. Welcome.
Hello.
Hi.
Here's my question. My mother, who grew up in California in the 20s and 30s and was actually a third or fourth generation Californian, is the only person I know who disliked the Golden Gate Bridge. She hated it. She always called it the building of the Golden Gate Bridge when they chained the Golden Gate. And I'm curious to know whether the writer has encountered anybody else who feels this way.
Well, Deborah, when the bridge was first proposed, a lot of people opposed it. The Sierra Club opposed it. The shippers opposed it, saying they couldn't get their ships underneath. The War Department was cautious, but eventually gave its approval. The great San Francisco novelist and historian Gertrude Atherton opposed it. Ansel Adams, the great photographer who had grown up in the site of the strait, was, shall we say, at best ambivalent to it and took photographs of the strait just before the construction to document what it was like untouched. And I think, Deborah, what you're emphasizing is that strait, the city had grown up alongside that open strait since San Francisco was established as an American city in 1847. So it was a big shock to say that a work of engineering could come across. But as Frank Dean suggests, and John Vanderzee brings this up in his wonderful book on the bridge, that like the Parthenon, the Golden Gate Bridge enhances its site. So over time, those objections, with the exception of your mother, the acceptance has been the exact opposite direction. But it's a cautionary tale that whenever you introduce a new project, whenever you alter things, you're going to have resistance.
Frank Dean, as superintendent for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, do you ever encounter people who don't like the bridge?
Not today. I mean, you know, like we said earlier, I actually have seen the Ansel Adams photograph, which is actually, I have a copy of it, in fact, a note card that shows the the strait without the bridge, and it's so dramatic. It's obviously beautiful, but and it's striking when you see that. But then then when you look at the bridge itself and you see how it sort of fits in there, I mean, you know, time marches on, and the bridge needed to be built at some level. It's just, we're just fortunate that it was done in such a design, and the simple elegance of the design was done so well. I think it just fits into the landscape quite nicely.
Here's Mike in Auburndale, Massachusetts. Hi, Mike. Welcome.
Yes, hi. Yeah, I just wanted to recall 1981, I was bicycling from Seattle to Los Angeles and met up with a bunch of Canadians and other bikers, and when we got to the bridge, we camped just north and then went in the morning and brought a couple bottles of champagne, stopped at the first, station, whatever, and popped the champagne and just sat there and just kind of gloried at the beauty of the bay in San Francisco. It was just really a remarkable event, and just want to remember that and share it. It was really super.
Glad you called, Mike. Thank you.
Jane, can I say something about
sure.
that? I think that that's a very, the sense of ritual that he had there, and he and his friends, et cetera, that when we say iconic, what do we mean by icon? Well, the work, the bridge is iconic. It's the same way that the Rockefeller Center building is iconic, or the Empire State Building, or Faneuil Hall in Boston, Hollywood sign. The bridge demands, in effect, or challenges us to sort of stop and meditate and celebrate the beauty of land and also the comparable beauty of human achievement when they're brought together properly.
And how are modern icons different, do you think, Kevin Starr? I know you have said that they're more ephemeral, no?
Well, I think the icons I named will be with us for some time. Once, I think the Golden Gate Bridge will be with us for some time because it makes a very powerful statement about American culture. I remember bringing Senator John Danforth from Missouri, who later our ambassador to the UN, across the bridge for the first time. He was almost like a boy, excited to see it. And because it makes a statement about American culture, that we can do things well, that we can handle the complexities of human culture in a landscape, that we don't have to eat up or use or defy or desecrate the landscape and the environment in order to have our human civilization. And I think as long as that message is there, as long as the bridge does its job, it'll be there. After all, if you see the movie about Star Trek, projecting out into the 500 years from now, I think Starfleet Academy is in San Francisco, and there's one scene in the movie where the Golden Gate Bridge is still there, alive and well.
Frank Dean, Acting Superintendent for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area, I'm curious, before I let you go here, what this bridge, the Golden Gate, means to you personally.
Well, as Kevin said, it's very symbolic. I think when I see that bridge, I'm impressed with its beauty and inspired by that. It makes me proud to see how that was built. It's quite a feat of engineering, but again, it was done so well. So it's sort of a feeling of inspiration and pride at the same time, and it's just beautiful to look at. And I'm fortunate that I get to see it every day.
Lucky you. I agree. Frank Dean, thank you so much for your time.
You're welcome.
Frank Dean, joining us from San Francisco, acting superintendent for the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. Kevin Starr, let me ask you about one sort of unfortunate point about the Golden Gate Bridge, and that is that it draws people from around the world who wish to take their own lives.
Absolutely. Although, Jane, recent survey has suggested, there are people from around the world, but recent survey has suggested that as far as we can tell, the majority of suicides come from the greater Bay Area. First of all, it's a four-second drop. It's a four-second drop, and it's almost certain death. There have been a few survivors, but very few. And the beauty, it's a reverse topography. The very beauty of the bridge, the enhancement of life, the calling to life and beauty of the bridge also has its reverse side of creating a maybe pseudo-romantic, again, I'm not a psychiatrist, but a kind of theatrical presentation for suicide and for certain suicide. And that is something that the bridge directors and the community has been struggling with for years, because there's certainly the accepted figure of 1,300 suicides since 1937, and some people could put it up as far as 1,400, given the fact that some people might not have been observed suicide at night and swept out to sea. And we're still struggling with that. Now, recently the bridge has authorized the creation of a metal net underneath the bridge to catch anybody who jumped. The financing of that is still uncertain.
I'm curious why that's taken so long, Kevin.
Well, it's very interesting. First of all, there was the argument that it defied the aesthetics of the bridge. That's how powerful the aesthetics were. Secondly, I think you didn't have the kind of sensitivity and activism to suicide. Especially, you have to give Marin County groups credit here. It began to dawn on people by the 1970s, 80s, 90s as psychiatry and study of suicide and anti-suicide counseling developed, that suicide was a mental disease, that it could be genetically related, and that people tempted to suicide, if resisting temptation for the first time, had a very good chance of survival. So over time, the suicides ceased to become seen as just an inevitable feature of the bridge and began to seem as something preventable. But even when that happened, the question of design not to affect the aesthetics of the bridge, I think, have delayed it.
I got to get some more calls in here. Let's go to Maria, Andover, Massachusetts. Hi, Maria. I'm so glad you waited. Welcome to the program.
Thank you. Hi.
Hi.
I just had a quick comment. When I lived in San Francisco for years, and I have a daughter who lives out there, and every time I visit and whenever I have friends who are going, I tell them to go to what I think is the best view of the bridge, which is from the Marin Headlands. And I don't know if your presenter could give people a really accurate way to get up there. As I remember it, going north on 101, after you get off the bridge, it's not the Fort Baker exit, it's the next one before Sausalito, and then you go under Route 101, and then you go up to the Marin Headlands, and you are actually looking back toward the city on top of the Golden Gate Bridge.
What's the best view for you, Kevin? Thanks, Maria.
I think Maria has described the best view. I agree with her 100%. And that roadway that you're talking about now, Maria, is very well, I think, marked now by the Golden Gate National Recreation Area. And if you've described it beautifully. You go under the tunnel and you go up there and you have a parking area. Then you can get out and walk along the headlands. You can look back and see the bridge from there. And you see the total composition from there. You see the bridge itself at a magnificent angle. You see San Francisco rising like Atlantis from the sea. You see the bay itself. And, of course, you see the wild Pacific. It's all a beautiful orchestration.
Here's Chester from Ganawungay, Canada. Did I get that right, Chester?
Close, yeah. Ganawungay.
Very good. I'm glad you called. Go ahead.
In 1984, I was an apprentice iron worker in San Francisco, and I worked for a company that was contracted to rebuild the bridge, to do the decking. I recall one day my foreman asked me to drag some hose, and I was working by myself on this special project, he said. He warned me not to drop what I was supposed to remove. As it turned out, it was the ceremonial rivet driven in, I guess, 1937. It's been a long time, and I left San Francisco in 1985. I told that story many times here at home, and just recently I emailed the board at the Golden Gate Bridge, asking whatever happened to that rivet, and they did do a search, it seems, according to how I read the emails, but I never got a sense that it was put on display or it was located and basically shown to the world. But I know I was told, you know, in very strict terms to do not drop this. I handed it over to my foreman. My foreman in turn gave it to four or five or six engineers. They're all dressed in white with white hats, and the last I saw them was them getting into their golf cart and driving back to the administration building. I'm just wondering if you know anything about that ceremonial rivet.
It's not been lost, Chester. It's in their possession, but in the district's possession. But I think you've suggested something larger, that when the bridge was first designed, Strauss wanted there to be a museum at the entrance to the bridge, a museum of the bridge construction and the elements of it. We don't have that yet. Maybe at some future point, that kind of museum will be opened up in the years to come, and under the GHENRA auspices, and that ceremonial last rivet will be able to be displayed properly.
Kevin Starr, we only have about a minute left, but I'm curious if you'd answer this question. What did the Golden Gate Bridge represent when it was built, and what do you think it represents today?
I think it represented a certain kind of recovery from the Depression, a certain kind of antidote to the Depression, that American industrialism could recover, the industrial economy could recover. And like the Brooklyn Bridge earlier, it also suggested that ultimately there was a certain quality, a hopeful quality to American urban and environmental life. Both the city and the country could be joined together. Like the Brooklyn Bridge, it made a statement, a cultural statement about America. Now, it didn't make it that way in sense of words like I'm using. The bridge doesn't need my words. It made it directly through the language of engineering and through public sculpture and through the serviceable work that the bridge does every day uniting the Bay Area.
Well, I have to say, I was a young girl growing up in Northern California. I had the pleasure of sailing once in the San Francisco Bay, and that bridge, boy, it is mesmerizing. Thank you so much for your time, Kevin Starr, and a fantastic book. We really appreciate your time today.
Thank you, James. Pleasure to be here.
Kevin Starr, University of Southern California professor and a state librarian of California emeritus. His new book is called Golden Gate, The Life and Times of America's Greatest Bridge. I'm Jane Clayson, in for Tom Ashbrook. Have a wonderful weekend, everyone. This is On Point.
Reach high, Golden Gate. Touch the clouds, Golden Gate.